So the work I'm going to present today is a group project at MIT. The other members of the group are Austin Clements, Yandong Mao, Alex Pestero, Franz Koshik, Robert Morris, and Nikolai Zeldovich. The question we're trying to answer with this work is, how hard is it to get applications to scale on Linux? For the purpose of this talk, you can think of a scalable application as one that does n times as much work on n cores as it could do on one core. In practice, scalability is usually limited by Amdahl's law, which implies that no matter how short your serial code paths are, they'll eventually come to limit the scalability of your application as the number of cores increases. Common causes for serial code paths include things like locks and shared data structures. It's also common for shared hardware like DRAM controllers or network cards to cause serialization. We think it's important to look at serial code paths in the OS kernel because many applications spend time in the kernel. For example, on a uniprocessor, the XML server spends about 70% of its time in the kernel. Many people run system-intensive applications like XM or Apache or Memcached, and it's important that the scalability of these applications continues to increase as more cores are added. The risk is, though, that if the OS kernel doesn't scale, none of these applications will scale either. Several kernel scalability studies seem to indicate that existing kernels don't scale well, and it's almost as if this risk is already a major problem. People have speculated that because existing kernels, or many existing kernels, are rooted in the uniprocessor error, fixing all these scalability bottlenecks is hard, and as a result, we've seen a number of new proposals for kernel designs. The questions we're trying to answer is, how serious are these scaling problems, and how hard is it to fix them? We think that it's difficult to answer these conclusively, but we feel that we shed some light on the answer by doing an analysis of Linux scalability. So to perform this analysis, we bought an off-the-shelf 48-core x86 machine, and we installed a recent version of Linux. We chose Linux because it's a popular OS, and in our experience, the scalability of Linux is competitive with a number of the other kernels we experimented with. Once we have Linux up and running, we picked out a set of applications and tried to scale them. Our criteria for selecting applications was that they have a good existing parallel implementation and that they be system intensive. That is, they make a lot of system calls and spend time in the kernel. So the contributions of this work are an analysis of Linux scalability for seven real applications. We did find that the stock Linux kernel limits scalability, and we provided an analysis of all the bottlenecks we encountered. We were able to fix all the bottlenecks in the kernel. It was 16 patches for about 3,000 lines of code. Most of our fixes improve scalability of multiple applications. And the remaining bottlenecks that applications bump into are either in the hardware or in the application itself. Our conclusion is that, at least for Linux, there are no real kernel scaling problems up to 48 cores. So our method for performing this analysis was to run an application, and for apps that wrote to the file system, we configured them to use an in-memory file system. This avoids the disk I/O bottleneck. It does, however, make some of our workloads less realistic, but it allows us to place a higher load on the kernel. We look for bottlenecks. Once we found one, if it's in the kernel, we fix it, and then we rerun the application and start this whole thing over again. We stop this iterative process when we hit a bottleneck that's in the application and requires a non-trivial fix, or is a bottleneck caused by some shared hardware resource, for example, DRAM. So this is just a high-level picture of the 48-core server we use. It's built out of 8 6-core AMD Opteron chips. The big gray squares represent the chips, and the little yellow squares represent the cores. So here's the result from running the seven applications on the 48-core machine. You'll probably recognize most of the applications, except for maybe the two on the right of the graph. PSearchy is an application that builds an inverted index on a set of files, and Metis is a multi-core MapReduce library. The y-axis of the graph is the throughput with 48 cores divided by the throughput with one core. So values towards 48 indicate great scaling. Values towards zero indicate terrible scaling. Linux seems to do okay for a couple of applications, but in general, most of the applications scale pretty poorly. For example, Apache handles just as many connections on 48 cores as it handles on one core. And solely based on this graph, things do look hopeless, and it seems reasonable to think about building a new operating system. And in fact, this is what I did a few years ago, and I even gave a talk here at OSDI about it. But now I'm back, and I want everyone to understand exactly what's going on. So to do that, I'm going to look at one application, describe some of the bottlenecks we encountered, and how we fixed them. So this is a graph of the scalability of XM. The y-axis is the throughput in terms of messages per second, and the x-axis is the number of cores. You'll notice that at around 40 cores, the scalability just collapses. And if we look at the amount of time spent in the kernel per message, it seems likely that the kernel is at fault for this collapse, because right around 40 cores, the kernel time spikes up. Here's a profiling output from running XM on 40 cores and on 48 cores. You don't really have to know much about this to understand what's going on. You just look at the percentage column, which indicates what percent of the execution cycles a function is consuming. On 40 cores, nothing really stands out. However, on 48 cores, this function lookup mount starts consuming 35% of the execution cycles. It turns out that the kernel calls lookup mount when it's opening a file on behalf of the application. As the kernel walks the file name path, every time it hits a mount point, it calls lookup mount to get some metadata about that mount point. And there are sort of two suspicious lines of code in this function, the call to acquire the VFS mount lock and the call to release it. And this critical section is relatively short. It's just indexing into a hash table, so it can't be more than tens of cycles. So even though lookup mount is acquiring this global lock, it's a little surprising that this short critical section causes this crash in scalability. The reason for this, though, is that spin lock and spin unlock are actually consuming many more cycles than a critical section itself. And to see why this is, it's useful to go over the Linux spin lock implementation for x86 CPUs. Linux uses non-scalable ticket-based spin locks. In the following slides, the cores highlighted pink are executing the lines of code highlighted pink. The cores highlighted blue are executing the lines of code highlighted blue. And this little purple rectangle represents a cache line holding the current ticket value and the next ticket value of a particular spin lock. So when a core tries to acquire a lock, the first thing it does is atomically read the next ticket value and increment it by one. When the core goes to execute this instruction to read the next ticket value, it'll cause the cache coherence protocol to send a request to the last core that held the lock, and that core will respond with the value of the next ticket value. And on a sort of a lightly loaded system, this transaction can take anywhere between 120 and 420 cycles. So we've already used up more cycles than it actually took to execute the critical section. After the pink core has his ticket, he checks to see if it's equal to the current ticket value. And if it is, he exits right away. Otherwise, the core sits in the while loop and spins. To release the spin lock, the lock holder simply increments the current ticket value. So the reason for the collapse we saw earlier is because the Linux spin lock implementation is non-scalable. And this isn't new news. Lots of people have pointed out that scalable spin locks can kill performance. But to demonstrate how this works in Linux, I'm going to go through another example. Assume that in this example, all the pink cores are sitting in the while loop waiting to acquire the lock. When the current lock holder goes to release the lock, it'll increment the current ticket value, which will cause the cache coherence protocol to broadcast on the interconnect that all the other cores need to invalidate their copies of the current ticket value. As soon as this happens, the cores waiting to acquire the lock will immediately try to reread the current ticket value, which will cause the cache coherence protocol to send a whole raft of requests back to the previous lock holder asking for what the current ticket value is. We've observed that when there's all these requests and invalidations flying around the interconnect, the delay between when a core sends a request for the current ticket value and when it receives a response can be anywhere between 500 and 4,000 cycles. The previous lock holder will, on average, send about send responses to half of the waiters before it finally notifies the core that'll next acquire the lock. In other words, the next lock holder has to wait for an amount of time proportional to the waiting number of CPUs before it knows that it has acquired the lock. And since this pattern repeats itself for all the waiters, you get this behavior where the total waiting time for some set of waiters to acquire the spin lock is proportional to the square of the number of waiters. So, you know, luckily, there are many well-known solutions to this problem. We could use scalable locks, or we could implement a scalable message passing scheme. We were, however, able to implement a solution that avoids locks in the common case. Our observation is that the mount table is rarely modified. So if we're able to improve the performance of lookup mount by making it lock-free at the cost of making updates more expensive, this will probably be a win for scalability. So our fix, which adopts a technique used all over the Linux kernel, is to add some per-core data structures. We added these per-core lookup tables, which essentially cache results from the global mount table. When a core calls lookup mount, first thing it does is query its local lookup table to see if it has the metadata that the core is looking for. If it does, it just returns. Otherwise, it goes a slow path and queries the global table and then inserts the metadata back into its per-core table so the next time it calls lookup mount, it doesn't have to mess with the global data. In the common case, this fix performs well because cores are only accessing their per-core data structures. However, it does make modifying the mount table more expensive because the kernel now has to invalidate all the per-core tables before it can update the mount table. So with this simple fix, scalability looks much better. The gray line is the throughput I showed earlier for the stock Linux kernel, and the blue line is the throughput using this per-core lookup table fix. You'll notice, though, that after about 32 cores, scalability starts to flatten out. And by looking at a profile output, there's no obvious reason why this is happening. However, it's hard to see using this profile output, but functions on 48 cores are actually executing more slowly than they were on 32 cores. And also, there's this function dput, which has sort of crept its way up the profile. It seems to be consuming a small but, you know, reasonable amount of CPU cycles. And it turned out that dput was actually causing other functions to execute more slowly. So to understand why that is, let me explain what dput does. Dput is used as, the kernel uses dput as part of its reference counting scheme. A reference count indicates when the kernel can free an object. So before a kernel thread accesses an object, it bumps the reference count. When it's done messing with the object, it decrements the reference count. And when a count hits zero, the kernel knows it's okay to free the object. The kernel uses reference counts for a number of objects. The particular one that XM is bumping up against is this file name cache object, or what's called a dentry. A dentry basically holds some metadata about an entry in a directory, and when a kernel thread is done using a dentry, it calls dput, which executes this atomic instruction to decrement the reference count. And this seems even more surprising than the short critical section in the lookup mount example, because a single atomic instruction now seems to be limiting scalability. And there are two reasons for this. One is it's similar to the lock case. Reading the reference count is probably slower than you might think. And the other is that reading the reference count actually delays memory operations from other cores. So I'm going to quickly go through an example of why reading the reference count is slow. Now the purple rectangle represents the cache line holding some dentry's reference count. When a core goes to decrement the reference count, the cache coherence protocol will send out a request to get the value of the reference count. And we saw that this can take 120 to 4,000 cycles depending on how much traffic there is on the interconnect. Reading the reference count also delays memory operations from other cores. And we think this happens because reading the reference count can cause congestion on the interconnect. And I'll give one example of how this might happen. On our AMD Opteron CPUs, when a core goes to execute an atomic instruction, the cache coherency protocol puts a cache line level lock on the operand of that instruction. So if it's decrementing a reference count, the reference count gets locked in one core's cache. If other cores simultaneously try to execute atomic instructions on that same reference count, the cache coherence protocol will send rejection notices back saying, sorry, I'm executing an atomic instruction, try again later. Eventually, when the cache lane level lock is released and the cores try again, one of the cores will get exclusive access to the cache line and be able to lock it into its cache. With all these rejections and requests coursing through the interconnect, it causes other memory traffic to be delayed, and this in turn causes functions or instructions that might be executing on other CPUs that depend on that memory traffic to execute more slowly. Our solution to this problem, which we call sloppy counters, is based on the observation that the kernel rarely needs the true value of a reference count. And so at a high level, we configure each core to hold a few spare references to popular objects. So I'm going to go through an example of using a sloppy counter for a d-entry. In the next set of slides, the little gray squiggles represent threads executed on the cores they're sitting next to. The first time a thread tries to access a d-entry, it's going to bump the shared reference count. And it's going to get a reference represented by the purple ball. When the core is done with the reference and wants to relinquish it, instead of decrementing the shared counter, it stashes away the reference in a per-core counter. If a thread executing on the same core wants to manipulate the same object, it can just grab the reference right out of the per-core counter. If multiple threads are running on the same core, they can just, and there's no per-core references sitting around, they can increment the shared counter just as before. And the per-core counters can cache multiple references to objects. At certain points, when the kernel's executing, it might want to collect the per-core counters to free the d-entry object. For example, if the user tries to remove a directory entry, and so the kernel will collect these per-core references and then disable the sloppy counter as soon as the final reference is relinquished by the thread on core 0, the kernel will know that it's okay to free this d-entry. Sloppy counters have the nice property that they're simple to start using. You can basically leave the old reference count in place, add a new member variable to a struct, and then replace contended usages of atomic instructions with their sloppy equivalents. In the common case, they scale well because there's no cache misses to acquire or release a reference to an object. They do, however, require memory proportional to the number of CPUs. So with our sloppy counter hack, we get even more scalability. The green line is the throughput with sloppy counters and the per-core lookup table. You'll notice that when I showed the profile, dput was only consuming 2.5% of the execution cycles, but performance at 48 cores improved by much more than that. And this is due to the fact that our fix to dput was able to alleviate some of the contention on the interconnect and allow other functions to execute more quickly. Okay, so we basically went through that same process with all seven of our applications, and here's a summary of our changes. I don't expect you to parse this entire table. I just want to point out two things. One is that most of our changes improve the performance of multiple applications, and the second thing is that we didn't modify several applications to avoid kernel bottlenecks. We only had to change about 3,000 lines of the code in the kernel, and making our changes was actually relatively easy. The more difficult part was trying to pinpoint these bottlenecks, and we spent most of our time was working on trying to figure out exactly what was causing the bottleneck. And then we made about 60 lines of changes to the applications. All of our techniques are well-known parallel programming tricks. Brian Cantrell describes most of these in an article he wrote 2 years ago. Here are the results from rerunning our seven applications on the patched kernel. Things certainly look less hopeless now. We get much better scalability. We think the reason we had to make very few modifications was that most of the potential bottlenecks we hit have already been taken out by the Linux community, and so we just sort of had to fix a few more that were popping up when we try to run on more cores. you might notice that none of the applications get perfect scalability. So here is a list of the current bottlenecks applications are hitting. Memcached and Apache are bottlenecked by the network card. XM, GMake, and Postgres hit bottlenecks in the applications themselves. And pSearch and Metis are bottlenecked by the memory system. Even though the kernel doesn't pop up as a bottleneck in any of the applications, we still think there's more research to be done on modifying the kernel to help applications avoid some of these bottlenecks. For example, the kernel was more active about partitioning the cache. pSearchy might get better performance. There are a number of limitations of this work. One is that our results are limited to 48 cores and a small set of applications. We think that if we ran on more cores or had a different set of applications, we'd bump into some of these looming problems. We talk about most of these in the paper. I mean, we've actually prototyped some fixes, so if you're interested in hearing about that, you can come talk to us. I mentioned earlier that applications that write to the file system were configured to use an in-memory file system instead of the disk. And it's important to point out that our 48-core machine is not equivalent to a single 48-core chip. For example, our machine has a ridiculous amount of DRAM bandwidth, and we think that a 48-core chip would have only a fraction of this DRAM bandwidth. There's a lot of related work. At the beginning of the talk, I mentioned the Linux and Solaris scalability studies. Groups in industry and academia have been building scalable multiprocessor Unix variants that scale up to hundreds of CPUs. The Linux community has pushed in lots of improvements into the Linux kernel. We think that our contribution is an in-depth analysis of kernel-intensive applications. So, the conclusion is pretty boring. Basically, Linux has scalability problems, and they're easy to fix or avoid up to 48 cores. The web page here has our benchmarking suite if you're interested in checking that out, and the kernel modifications will be up there soon. That's it. Thanks.
Hi. Hi. Eric Van Hensburg in IBM Research. Good results. Good talk. What's been your experience pushing your changes into mainline?
Yeah, we haven't tried.
Why not?
Because I've been working on the talk. I don't know. We've talked about it. Some of the changes are probably less likely to ever have, make it into the kernel. Like, I don't know, sloppy counters probably are pretty questionable. They're much better solutions than actually using sloppy counters. Have you looked at the paper?
No, I haven't looked at the
details. Well, we did some networking hacks that seemed like they might be useful to a broader audience.
Do you intend to try to submit?
We intend to think about it, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Margo Seltzer from Harvard University.
Hi, Margo. So
I really like the study. It's nice to see some real numbers about what's going on. But I guess it seems that the conclusion of what you've done is not fundamentally different from what led you to do Cori, right? Which is that on these massively parallel processors, shared state is just really bad. And so, it would be depressing to think that we're all relegated to spending the next two decades going through this process every time we go from 48 to 64 to 128 threads and finding the next piece of shared state that we need to get rid of. So it seemed like what you were saying is, we don't need an OS. We just have to keep hacking the current OSs to make them more scalable. But it seems that we still have this fundamental problem that most of our operating systems really are built around a shared state model. And if you work really, really hard, you can attack them one at a time. But do you really believe that that's the right way to go?
No.
Okay, thanks.
Just based on this study, all I can say is that up to 48 cores, that approach seems to work well. It might be the case, when you run on 96 cores, there's some fundamental problem in the way Linux was designed and using shared data structures that just make it impossible to...
But what do you really think? What do you think?
I have no idea. I mean, if you were sort of a gambling person, you could say since it was easy to sort of make the changes up to 48 cores, it might be easy to continue doing that, but I couldn't really say. It would be nice to have some study that would give me a sense to make a more educated guess, but I don't know.
Shel Ma from University of Illinois. Thanks for the talk first. My question is, what's your comments on running one single application on 48 cores versus you run multiple applications? One application takes like 10 cores or 12 cores. So how many of your optimizations will work for only scale one application to many, many cores versus one machine you have multiple applications?
What was the question?
Like general enough you can you work for either scenarios or?
Is the question, do I think our changes are general?
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, we didn't target certain applications for our changes. We sort of make these general changes and the performance of multiple applications would improve. So,
okay.
And that's all I can say. It might be the case that, you know, you run a whole different set of seven applications and none of our changes work. But, I don't.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Hi, Chris Head from University of BC. For the sloppy counters, mm-hmm. your plan was to keep a separate counter for each CPU so that you'd avoid moving cache lines between CPUs, correct?
Sure.
So cache lines are fairly large. Cache lines are a lot bigger than typical reference counts. So how did you implement that? Did you pack the reference counts for multiple objects into cache lines per core, or did you just waste a lot of space for that?
Well, the amount of space you need for a sloppy count is proportional to the number of CPUs. So.
Yes, but the thing is that a cache line is a lot bigger than an integer, so
if you have multiple sloppy counters, you can pack the per core counters from different counters into the same cache line.
Yes. My point is then you have to manage those counters separately from the objects because they're not just a single memory allocation, right?
That's true, right.
Did you find that introduced a lot of overhead?
For some objects. For example, in Linux, sockets allocate a d-entry. And if you allocate a d-entry for a socket, it's a lot of overhead, essentially, because sockets are so ephemeral and short-lived. And so basically the fix was don't allocate a d-entry until for a socket.
Okay.
Eddie Kohler, UCLA in Meraki. I really, really enjoyed this paper. I love the way it's written as well. This is a follow-on to Margot's question, so I imagine the answer is going to be equally annoying for you to have to give. But here's a hypothesis about kernel structure, which is that when you have a kernel like Linux, which is just one big ball of stuff, the reason that that kernel organization sort of wins over the long term, perhaps, is that because all of the code is in one place, in one shared memory address space, it's easier to make larger changes as well as smaller changes. So you have some experience with different kernel organizations. Did you find that to be the case here?
That it was easier to make changes to the Linux kernel than some other kernel?
Well, some of the alternative kernel structures that people are thinking about for scalability sort of lose this property. So I wonder.
I'm unsure what property it is and why they lose it.
I think I'll take it offline.
Okay.
Hi, Amitai Avibram. Thank you again for a wonderful paper. Very interesting.
Oh, thanks.
So I understand. Let's go back to the first big problem, which was spin locks. I understand why spin locks would cause this degradation in scalability, and the solution works well. But I don't understand why your original results had an elbow in the curve, rather, you know. Where your scaling was fine up to 40 cores, and then you had this elbow down at going from 40 to 48. So what happens at that threshold?
You mean why is it exactly at 40 cores, or why does it go down?
Well, yeah, like what causes there to be? It's not just kind of a gradual degradation. You've got this real threshold going from 40 to 48 that causes spin locks all of a sudden to be a problem.
Well, there's two problems. One problem is that the interconnect on the machine becomes congested.
Uh-huh.
And so when it's fully utilized, packets get more delayed, and it becomes much more expensive to acquire the spin lock. And so, and then you'll notice that, well, I don't know if I want to go all the way back, but lookup mount was only consuming 35% of the CPU cycles, but we got a much greater performance improvement than 35%.
Right.
So that was sort of indicating that not only was lookup mount expensive, but it was slowing down other things by congesting the interconnect. And then the other effect was this n squared thing, that when you have n waiters, the total wait time is actually proportional to the square of the number of waiters.
Okay. Thanks.
Uh-huh.
One last. So should we or should we not be designing new architectures for multi-core operating systems?
Hardware architectures or something?
Operating system architectures.
Oh.
The obvious question.
I
in other words, could you have published the papers in the opposite order? Silas and I will discuss this.
All I can say is that up to 48 cores, it doesn't seem like Linux is a problem. So
thank you very much.
I hope we'll have more.
Good answer. Thank you.